On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Stephen Novello discusses near-death experience research.
You and I are talking about the research. We're talking about what's published, how to interpret it, what different people are saying. I know there's a range of opinion on this. I know that there are dedicated NDE researchers who think that it's a dualist explanation. I've read them. I know what they say. But there are also people on the other side who have, in my opinion, very cogent arguments against that. There isn't a consensus. You know, I'm obviously on one side. I'm very compelled by the neuroscientific arguments because that's in my specialty, and I can very clearly relate to them.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, I have an interview with Dr. Stephen Novello to discuss his take on near-death experience research. Now, as many of you know, on the last episode of Skeptico, we reviewed Dr. Novello's comments regarding this research, kind of as a prep to get the ball rolling to tee up some issues in advance of this interview. And I think, as you'll hear, it did stir up a lot to talk about. It's a pretty dense interview. And I had originally planned to publish it without any comments. But like I say, the interview is quite dense, and it has a lot of references to issues for follow-up. Steve would say something or reference a bit of research, and I'd say, great, I'll follow that up, and we just kind of leave that issue. Well, since the interview, I started to do that follow-up, and I really want to share some of my findings with you, because as is so often the case here on Skeptico, the follow-up, the pulling apart, the digging through what is said is often just as interesting or sometimes even more interesting than the interview itself. So I've included some of those findings at the end of this interview. But just to give you a flavor for what I mean, I want to share with you one bit of follow-up I've done regarding the NDE CO2 study that we've talked so much about in the last few episodes. We've talked about it not so much because of the significance of the research, but because the way it was covered and how that reveals so much about the state of near-death experience science. Anyway, during the last episode of Skeptico, I pointed out that Steve had made some errors in his analysis of the study. Now, in the interview you're about to hear, you'll hear Steve say that I was wrong, that I had misread the study. And then I say, no, he was wrong. And I can now report to you that we're both right. And that we're both wrong. Let me break it down a little bit. Big picture, I was right to point out that he reported on a study that concluded the opposite of what he said. The study concludes it is not thought possible to explain NDEs only in terms of physiological processes. So their conclusion is mind not equal brain. And of course, Steve is saying the exact opposite of that, which is fine, except, well, he's the one who cited this study as evidence for his position. Okay, but back to some more of the details of this. Steve was right to point out that in the study, when they say out-of-hospital resuscitation, they don't really mean that in the way that we would normally think about it, or certainly in the way that I was thinking about it. So they do, in fact, have CO2 data from when they were performing CPR, and they have it afterwards, as I reported. But regarding the details of that data, I was right to point out that the CO2 levels are elevated after resuscitation, 6.6 as opposed to 5.7 during resuscitation. Now, you'll hear Steve say the opposite of that during the interview, but I went back and checked, and those are actually the numbers. And I was also right to point out that those aren't particularly high levels of CO2. Doctors run into plenty of situations where patients are at those levels, and they're not having NDEs. And then Steve was right to point out that both those measurements, the during CPR and after CPR, correlate statistically to the NDE group as opposed to the non-NDE group. Although I have to add, that was never really a point that I made. And finally, we were both right to conclude that this is kind of a throwaway study that doesn't mean much. Again, very small sample size, contradicts previous research, all of that stuff. Okay, so that's a lot of detail on a study, especially one that we both agree is not all that significant. But I think, as you can see, you really have to tear it apart to really figure out what's being said, what's really going on, and form an opinion about which side you're going to take in this whole thing. So I have more analysis, more follow-up following the interview. But for right now, let's jump into my interview with Dr. Stephen Novello. Today we welcome back to Skeptico Dr. Stephen Novella, host of the very popular Skeptic's Guide to the Universe show. Steve also runs the Neurological blog and makes frequent media appearances representing the skeptical community. And those are just his side interests. During the day, he's a highly regarded academic neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine. And with that, Steve, welcome back, and thanks for joining me tonight.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great. You know, Steve, as you know, on the last podcast of Skeptico, I responded to some statements you had made about near-death experience research, and you were nice enough to come back on so we could sort through exactly where you're coming from and how you view this phenomena, and that's what I thought we'd do tonight.
Sure.
So let me tee that up then a little bit. So as I just mentioned, the last episode of Skeptico, we talked a lot about near-death experience, and actually we have been for quite a few episodes now trying to interview as many skeptical researchers as well as proponents as we can possibly reach out to. Now, the two things that I focused on in the last show was, one, your claim that there's a lot of evidence that's triangulating, I think is the word that you used, triangulating
right.
on the idea that there's a conventional explanation for near-death experience, and that explanation is probably most likely centered around the idea that these folks are hypoxic. They're losing oxygen to their brain, and that's what's causing this phenomena. So that's point one. And then point...
Well, can I clarify that a little bit?
Sure.
I think that, you know, we need to take a hierarchical approach to explanations. What I think is, and I believe what I said, is that the evidence is triangulating on the notion that it's a brain phenomenon. Now, the deeper question of what exactly is going on in the brain to cause it, I think we don't know what the answer to that is. There's lots of clues. There's lots of possibilities, hypoxia being only one of those. I don't think we can conclude at this point in time that hypoxia is what's causing the NDE. I think it's a very viable explanation. So I just wanted to back up on that. My point is that it's that the evidence is clearly pointing to it being a brain phenomenon of some sort.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you did say that the near-death experiences are remarkably similar to what happens to the brain when it's deprived of oxygen. So I do think, you know, you said both. You didn't say it was absolutely positively. That was the only explanation, but that's what I picked up on. That's, I guess, what I was responding to. So
that's fine. That was a brief discussion on our show about it, and I think we can go into a little bit more detail here. I think that also for further context, it has to be noted that the consensus also seems to be moving in the direction, you know, among neuroscientists who are looking at this issue, that near-death experience or NDE is not one phenomenon either. It's descriptively very broad, and it may in fact have as many different causes as there are types of experiences that people describe that are being lumped into this sort of broad category of experiences we're calling near-death experiences.
Boy, and there's a jumping off point right there. I don't see where in the literature you can really point to, particularly among the near-death experience researchers, where there is this broad collection of different symptoms that are being kind of lumped together or experiences that are being lumped together. If anything, it seems like they're honing in more and more with the Grayson scale being adopted more and more, like we're going to talk in a minute about the Climaticides CO2 study, you know, using the same with Kevin Nelson at University of Kentucky, you know, using this same criteria, the same scale to evaluate near-death experiences. So where are you coming from when you mention that there's these kind of constellation of different things that are being broadly categorized as near-death experiences?
Well, first of all, if you think about the core experience, right, the things that people are calling, in fact, the core NDE experiences, there is no single feature that's experienced by everyone who meets criteria for having an NDE. And if these criteria are purely descriptive, it's basically people interviewing, you know, those who have had near-death experiences, describing, you know, and recording what they report, and then just finding the commonalities among those reports and saying, all right, that's the core experience. But if you look at, for example, in Ring's published data, you know, if you look at each of the main features, separation from the physical body reported 37% of the time, entering a region of darkness, again, in the minority of time, seeing a brilliant light, 16% of his patients, going through a tunnel or entering another realm was around 10%. So those are the core experiences, and we're getting 37%, 10%. The peace and well-being was reported 60% of the time. That's the highest number. So that's hugely variable. In addition, there's different situations in which these occur, and it's basically the studies will focus on different patient populations. So of course, if you're looking at cardiac arrest survivors, that's going to be homogenous because that's the criteria that you're looking at. But these same elements are also reported during anesthesia, during situations where people are hypoxic, like pilots who have become hypoxic have described elements of these near-death experiences.
I don't jump in on that one. I don't think that's what the data really says, at least my read of it, Steve. When you talk about hypoxia, the symptoms of hypoxia, both the subjectively reported symptoms by the people who have had that experience and the objective doctor saying that's what we observed, to me seem to be exactly the opposite of what near-death experience researchers are saying patients are reporting back. I mean, the classic signs of hypoxia: inattentiveness, poor judgment, confusion, amnesia, and the list goes on, but they're all of that kind of general.
Yeah, but you said it, Alex. Those are the signs of hypoxia, and a sign is something that you observe in somebody. A symptom is something that the person experiences themselves. And even when people are observed to look delirious with hypoxia, they may report that during that period of time they had the peace and well-being, a euphoric episode. They also at times will report the hyperclarity or hyperattentiveness that is described by NDE experiencers. So the memory, the subjective experience of some people who are having clear-cut, you know, hypoxic episodes does overlap with NDEs. I think you were just absolutely wrong on that part. You're confusing what people observe and what the people who experienced it remember and report as their subjective experience. And again, keep in mind that we're still, you didn't really address my original point where the core experiences are occurring between 10 and 60% of the time. This is a hugely variable experience that we're talking about. And the fact, I don't think that everyone who reports an NDE is having hypoxia. I think probably just a subset are. And we still need to sort out, and this is where the literature is very vague on this, we still need to sort out which features are more likely to be present in which kinds of situations. I think that there has yet to be a consensus on the data on that.
Well, there's a lot of different strings we can pull at here, but let's pull at one because I think you misinterpreted what I was saying. Actually, if you look at some of the reports, particularly with pilots, as you mentioned, the subjective symptoms of hypoxia, and I'm reading right off of one, and I'll post for everyone the report that this came from. But here are the subjective experiences that the pilots reported: fatigue, headache, dizziness, hot and cold flashes, euphoria, belligerence, blurred vision, tunnel vision, numbness, tingling. These are not the symptoms of near-death experience, which I reported in mine are vividness, increased sense of awareness, increased memory, realer than real experience. These two don't really match up, and I think to suggest that they do, you really got to make a lot of leaps there.
Well, first of all, I'm not saying that pilots who are experiencing hypoxia are having a near-death experience. That's not what I'm saying at all, because the experience that they're having is nowhere near what is happening to somebody who, you know, is having a cardiac arrest, for example, and needs to have resuscitation. So we wouldn't expect the experiences to be the same. I'm saying that there are some elements of overlap, like you specifically mentioned euphoria and tunnel vision, but also what you're reading is not the full description of the kinds of different experiences that have been reported. And pilots have reported the sort of hypervividness and clarity, as well as hallucinations, during the episodes of hypoxia. Again, I'm not saying it's an NDE. I'm just saying there are elements of it. And most of the other situations in which we say, here's something that's happening that overlaps with some of the elements of an NDE. It's not a full-blown NDE. So, for example, if you under ketamine, which is a drug, that can produce similar kinds of out-of-body experiences and euphoria that overlaps with an NDE. We can pretty much produce out-of-body experiences at will these days by stimulating the right part of the brain. And it's the exact kind of out-of-body experience that's reported by those who have a near-death experience, where they're floating above their body, they're looking down upon their body and the scene. That's been reported during seizures. It's been reported during, you know, non-dominant temporal lobe stimulation, specifically the angular gyrus during epilepsy surgery, for example. So to me,
but you know, you just not, I just,
it's
have
not
to,
an NDE. Again, it's not,
no,
an
I'm not
NDE,
saying it's not,
but
an
it's
NDE.
An element, but it's an out-of-body experience, which is one of the things on the list of symptoms that sometimes occur in some people with NDEs.
Well, I'll do a full follow-up on that, but I was just reading an article published in the Journal of Near-Death Studies, I think it is, that directly refutes what you're saying about the out-of-body experience during seizure and the out-of-body experience by temporal lobe stimulation as being dramatically different than the out-of-body experience that's reported in near-death experience. And the authors of the paper went to great lengths to point out, I think you're referring to an article that appeared in Nature magazine in 2002, where it was first reported of the temporal lobe stimulation creating the out-of-body experience. And there's significant major differences. And I think that's, you know, this is a very useful...
Like what? What difference? I mean, people say I'm floating outside my body, hovering above my body, near the ceiling.
Yeah, they don't say that. See, they don't say that.
Well, Alex, I had a patient who told me that directly, that he had a seizure, and during his seizure, he had temporal lobe epilepsy, and that's exactly what he described. And that's, I'm not talking about a paper. This has been described over and over again in multiple scenarios, seizures and epilepsy surgery only being one. We can produce it now with transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Are
I think
you're
looking at a very
Persinger?
Tiny...
Are you talking about Persinger?
Well, that was the original description from years ago, but again, there's much more recent data looking at transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is, you know, we could much more reliably focus on different parts of the brain and either increase or decrease cortical activity. And so, you know, this is becoming much more reproducible. I think, again, you can't just look at the NDE literature and get a feel for what we know neuroscientifically about how the brain works. Most of the research that I think is relevant is just understanding how the brain functions, is looking at the neuroscience of, you know, what happens when we stimulate or turn off different modules in the brain and what happens. It's very clear now, very well established, that our sense of being inside of our bodies is something that is actively produced by different parts of the brain. And when you interfere with that, with those parts of the brain, it gives you a feeling of being outside of your body, having an out-of-body experience. So,
you know, that's
well established.
I'd love for you to provide me with references to where you think that best research is. Because if it's Blank or Olof, I mean, we've looked at those, and again, what they really say is that exactly what you said, that when we interfere with the brain's understanding of this sense of self, we can create some of the symptoms of the mm-hmm. out-of-body experience, but that it's substantially different in many respects to what we're seeing.
Like what?
Particularly the floating outside and being able to see the entire view of what's going on versus the sensation, the feeling of being outside and being able to observe and take in information and see and hear things that are going on both there and other places. But I think that's great. I'm very open to hearing that and pursuing that. You know, in the format of Skeptica, we really dig into things in great depth. And I'll drill into that as far as need be and try and contact those researchers and have them come on. And the last guy I had speak specifically to this topic that you're talking about was Dr. Peter Fenech. And mm-hmm. you know, he's one of the most highly regarded neuropsychiatrists in the UK and in the world. And he appeared to me, Steve, to be extremely well-versed in the out-of-body experience literature, both from a neuroscience standpoint and from an NDE standpoint, and he felt quite confident saying that there was a substantial differences. And then we can get back to this other point too, that I think, you know, if you're trying to make the connection between hypoxia and near-death experience, great, love to see folks who have done it, but I'm a little bit resistant to jumping on this kind of casual, hey, doesn't euphoria sound like lucid experience in some way? I think what really needs to be done is some real hard-nosed breaking apart of what people are really experiencing and matching them up. And that's why we had on, you know, Dr. Jeff Long, who did a 150-question survey where he, you know, extensively went through asking multiple questions, multiple different ways to try and dig into what people were really saying when they said they had a real experience, or when they said that 96% of what they encountered was accurate and realistic, so i.e. not hallucinatory. Because one of the things that you just mentioned before, I think, is another trap that NDE, I don't want to say skeptics, but people who are not sold on the NDE as being indicative of a separate consciousness separate from the brain, what they immediately lump these experiences into is being hallucinatory. And what the data is coming back from the NDE researchers is just the opposite, that these folks are reporting that these are very non-hallucinatory experiences in terms of how they're experiencing it. And people can tell the difference, right? We know what dreamlike means because we all dream. People who have hallucinations can differentiate between saying, that's a hallucination. My car turned into a lion. That was a hallucination.
Well, that's actually only true part of the times. There are certain types of hallucinations that people know that they know they're not real. And there are certain that they don't know are not real. And in fact, that's a diagnostic criteria that we use in order to distinguish different types of hallucinations. So it really depends. And again, I think what you're doing, Alex, is trying to dismiss certain, you know, the neurophysiological explanations because they don't meet all of the features of an NDE. But you really can't dismiss them on those grounds. Again, I think if you look at this as, you know, there's probably multiple different things that all produce elements of an NDE. There are multiple like pathways that can be taken to get there, and nothing is going to be the exact same as, for example, having a cardiac arrest and undergoing CPR. So I wouldn't expect anything else to produce the entire experience that's really similar to an NDE. But I think it's relevant that there is a part of the brain that when you turn it off, it makes people feel like they're floating outside their body. And that is what people who have an NDE experience and report. I think it's, you know, it's very interesting that there's a part of the brain that, you know, can also give you, you know, euphoric experiences, or that we know that neurochemically, for example, this is another sort of physiological hypothesis that during the extreme stress of either hypoxia or, you know, having a cardiac arrest, that endorphins can be released as a neuroprotective chemical, and that endorphins, when they bind to receptors, can produce euphoria and the kind of, you know, everything is pleasant experience that some people report with an NDE. And in fact, it's been reported that in patients who have had naloxone, which blocks those receptors, that they have the more negative NDE experience. And you know, why would a drug change the way someone experiences their near-death experience unless it were a brain phenomenon?
Great. I'd love to look at that study too. Please, yeah, that's send me that reference.
I will send you a good overview that gives you all of these references that I'm going to be talking about tonight.
Great. Before I lose my train of thought, because I thought it was interesting what you were saying about me dismissing the neurological basis for this, because it seems to me like I could take the path, the logic stream that you were going there, and kind of turn it around. I mean, why would we expect someone who is under general anesthesia for whatever operation, and someone who suffers sudden cardiac arrest, and someone who's drowning, all very different from a physiological standpoint, from a neurological standpoint. Why would we expect, as we do find, that their experiences are very, very similar in terms of near-death experiences?
And again, there's an easy explanation for that. It's because the symptoms of neurological phenomenon are not determined by the cause. It's determined by what parts of the brain are not working, and that's it. So I can damage a certain part of your brain in 100 different ways. It would all produce the same symptoms because those symptoms are determined solely by which brain cells are not working, not by what the insult was.
But hold on. I mean, the real point on that, I hear where you're going, but let me fine tune it so that that's a fine answer, but apply it to this. When someone's drowning, the breakdown of the brain and the brain cells is gradual, slow. We know that, right? Cardiac arrest, we know it's much more sudden. Anesthesia, we have no way of explaining why there would be any conscious experience. Yet the experience that's reported across all of these is the same.
Well, again, I disagree that they're the same in that you're still talking about a very broad experience with lots of features that are no single feature is present every time. A lot of the core features are present even in a minority of cases. So I don't think
that's the Kenneth Ring data that you pulled, which is fine. I mean, that's one way to slice.
But
the
even
data.
That's one data. But I mean, even if you just look at anyone's description of it, there's no description.
Jeff Long's description. You know, I mean, the percentages are much higher. Like I told you, 90.
But nothing's 100% though.
Well, so it doesn't have to be 100%. You're saying the percentages are very low, which I admit, one thing. If they're 16%, 20%, but when realer than real experience is 76%, when realistic data reported is in the high 90s, when meeting only deceased relatives is in the high 90s. It really puts a completely different spin on this idea that we don't have a lot to grab onto, because we do.
Well, I'm not saying, I think that what this means is it's reasonable to hypothesize that there are different kinds of experiences here that have neurological overlap. And again, as a neurologist, this is this kind of explanation makes perfect sense to me, because we see this in all areas of neurology where we have different kinds of disorders, maybe with completely different causes, that have similar symptoms, because there are final common pathways of neurology, of how things operate. And if you can interfere with some function in multiple ways, and it will cause a lot of overlap of symptoms. So I think that's the way to approach this.
We're directly, I don't know, I hear what you're saying in a way, but it seems to be contradictory to what I'm saying. If somebody has a cardiac arrest and we know that their brain is going to shut down within 10 to 15 seconds of that, why would we expect...
Could be a little longer than that, yeah.
Okay, well, why would we expect that experience to be similar to someone who is in and out of consciousness while they're drowning? Or why would we expect that experience to be the same as someone who's under general anesthesia, who, you know, even if you speculate and say there's anesthesia awareness there, I mean, there's all sorts of symptoms that are associated with anesthesia awareness that we don't see. So for you to kind of funnel that all into this common pathway of what's going on neurologically, to me, I don't see how you get there.
I think it makes perfect sense, but I also think that you're mixing two other kinds of, you're at least assuming that two potentially different kinds of phenomena are one thing. So just to back up a little bit, there are three kinds of broad categories of explanations for NDEs. And I don't have any, you know, bias going into this. I just, like anybody else, want to understand this as best as I can. The three basic kinds of explanations are, one, it's spiritual, that it represents the fact that the mind can exist separate from the brain. The second
is psychological. That isn't in and of itself spiritual, right? A separate mind from brain isn't necessarily spiritual, right? I mean, it's just...
Well, it's non-materialistic. I mean, right. there is no materialistic.
It's dualist.
So, yeah, it's dualist. I don't want to get caught up on the word spiritual, but you know what I'm getting at. It's a dualist, that mind separate from body explanation. The second one is that it's a psychological experience. of some sort. And then the third is that it's organic. It's neurophysiological. I think that the evidence and some of the best explanatory models that people are putting forward are blending the second two, the psychological and the organic, the neuroscientific. I think there are some psychological explanations that have been correctly dispensed with. I don't think this is a triggered birth memory. I think that was kind of a silly idea. So there are some that I think have nothing to do with NDEs. But then there are others, and again, I think you got this wrong on the previous show when you were talking about this. There are others that are culturally specific and appear to be psychological. So I think what we're seeing is that there's a core experience. You know, there's six or seven or so very, very common, although not universal, elements to the NDE that are considered the core experience. I think that's primarily organic. It's what just the kinds of things that can happen to the brain under various kinds of stress. And the reason why those are cross-cultural is because it's a brain phenomenon, not a cultural phenomenon.
Like, what are those? What are you talking about when you mention? Because I think the data does say exactly the opposite of that. What are the cross-cultural aspects that have been reported that you think you see directly tie back to physiological, you know, brain function?
Well, again, I want to complete my point, but just to go over that again, I think that things like sometimes feeling euphoria, sometimes feeling an out-of-body experience, the tunnel vision, the bright light, I think those sort of are probably more physiological, so a brain phenomenon. And therefore, it doesn't matter what culture you're from, if your brain is shutting down in a certain way, that's the kind of experience you're going to have. But then, so that is occurring during some kind of physiological stress while it's at the very beginning of a cardiac arrest before the brain totally shuts down, or during a drowning episode, or maybe during anesthesia or some other kind of stress. And then patients are unconscious for a while. After a severe episode like a cardiac arrest, patients will probably be unconscious for a day or two. Then they're slowly waking up. They remember this really unique experience that they had that they have no way of dealing with in their ordinary experiences of life, because you know they were literally having an experience with a different subset of their brain, and they're trying to make sense of it. They're trying to remember exactly what it was that they experienced. Meanwhile, they're not really fully out of their delirium or whatever they're passing through on the way to fully waking up. And then I think that's where a lot of the cultural elements come into play. When they're trying to process this memory and this experience, they're trying to remember it. This is probably a life-altering event for them. So I'm sure emotions are running extremely high. And when you look at those elements, like meeting deceased people, you know, where it's a more of a cultural element, then you get higher percentages within a culture, but it also differs when you look at different cultures.
It's not true, Steve.
It is absolutely true. I mean, I'm sure the literature is probably mixed on this, but there absolutely are studies that show that there are cultural differences in those kinds of experiences.
Well, there are some cultural differences, like you pointed out, in terms of seeing religious figures associated with your background. There's also cultural differences in the language they use. Tunnels for some and holes for others. But what we can focus on those languages, but they're primarily language and they're specific to these religious figures. But what kind of contradicts what you're saying, I mean, one, I don't know how much you've really immersed yourself in the near-death experience research. I mean, Bruce Grayson, Jeff Long, who we've had on the show, but there, you know, and Jeff Long, who we had on a couple times, I mean, he's compiled the largest database of near-death experiences and did it in a very scientific way. He's a medical doctor. He knows what he's doing. It just completely contradicts what you're saying. And in the cross-cultural part, for example, the deceased relatives, you know, one thing that kind of jumps out at you there is these folks, when they see relatives, they only see deceased relatives, 92%. cross-culture. Okay, that doesn't fit in your model. There's no reason why someone from Singapore would only see deceased relatives versus, you know, these are cross-cultural kind of things that shouldn't really be there. The life review.
Well, I don't think you could say that. Well, first of all, okay, we're jumping on to different points, but the life review is actually, that's a brain phenomenon. So I wouldn't, that can be induced, again, by physiological stress to the brain.
Another one is I'm sorry.
But you know, the thing is, while there are the things that are different among cultures, like religious belief and the importance of certain things like food or whatever, you know, if you look at those kind of elements that are very specific to one culture or another, those things differ in how patients are remembering and making sense of their near-death experience.
Sure,
those things that are universal, that are, you know, there are some things which are universal across cultural, even though they may not be purely neurological, you're going to see 90% of the time. You know, like, yeah, if people are trying to make sense of a near-death experience, you know, sure, they're going to see people that they know are dead. Why wouldn't that be cross-cultural? I mean,
why wouldn't it be different? you can fit it into any box, but there's,
but death is death. I mean, why people don't, you think they think of death, you think they in Asia they think that people are alive or in the afterlife? I mean,
when you dream, you don't only see deceased people in your dream.
I don't think near-death experiences have anything to do with dreams. I don't think it's a dreamlike experience. That's a specific neurological phenomenon that is not going on with NDE.
Okay, and so then you believe Kevin Nelson's work, University of Kentucky, you completely are on the other side of that REM intrusion thing that was hit the media and was really big about a year ago.
Yeah, you know, I'm not convinced by the REM intrusion hypothesis. I think it's an interesting idea. I think we would need to see a lot more specific data in that direction to make me think that that's happening. But even if it was REM intrusion, it still is not a dream state, because, you know, REM sleep or REM, you know, dreaming is different. It is a very specific neurological state. And that is certainly not the state of people who are having a near-death experience. That doesn't mean that there can't be elements of that, of, you know, again, of neurological function that's involved in dreaming, that then can get involved in the period of time in which people are forming memories that they then later report as a near-death experience. So I don't think we can rule that out. My point is that we have to be clear on the fact that dreaming is not a pathological state. It is a normal state of our brain, but that doesn't mean that pathological states can't somehow involve, you know, neurological structures that are also involved with REM or with dreaming.
Okay. Well, I have to jump. You're going to give me so much material here to sort out and go follow up on, which is great. I love to do it, and I appreciate it.
But just the one thing,
really,
you threw out a lot of references. Let me just give you one reference. There was an article by John Belanti where he specifically looked at a cross-cultural perspective of near-death experience, and he showed that that as the cultural elements varied, so did the NDE experience. And I could send you that reference.
Sure, I'll be happy to follow up on it and talk to as many people as I can and find out where that really shakes out. You know, I would have to back up, though, because one of the major points that you just made, which, again, I just don't see any support of in the literature, is this idea that you have that these memories are being formulated after the fact and are somehow being formed based on their psychological factors that drive them to do that. And the research that I mentioned and I spoke with her on our show here is, you know, Dr. Penny Sartori, and that's been corroborated by other researchers who've gone back and trying to match the resuscitation experience and what the experiencer remembers about the resuscitation experience and compare that to the group of cardiac arrest patients who didn't have a near-death experience. And the results are dramatic. I mean, it's dramatically more likely that they're able to recount accurately their resuscitation experience if they had an NDE as opposed to if they didn't. And the bottom line of that is it again directly contradicts this idea that you have that they're somehow formulating all these memories after the fact.
Well, there's the rub, right? I mean, so now we get to the real thing that can distinguish between a mind separate from body experience versus a purely neurological, psychological experience, right? A brain experience is during the period of time when someone is undergoing CPR after, you know, the first 30 to 60 seconds or so, it is fairly quick, but it could be up to a minute or so, where depending on exactly, you know, how catastrophic the cardiac arrest is, where they're not getting enough blood supply to the brain, or they're not getting any blood supply, the brain starts to shut down. After about a minute, the EEG goes flatline, right? And it's going to be flatline now for hours. And will slowly come back if they're successfully resuscitated. During that time when the EEG is flatline, I think everyone would agree that the brain is not going to be making memories, right? In its ordinary, you know, way that it does with brain function. And so therefore, if we could really demonstrate that patients were having experiences that they had to be having during that period of time, that would certainly call into question our current models of neuroscience and the whole mind-body, mind-brain connection. I agree with that. But I and many others don't think that there is any evidence that definitively rules out that those experiences are forming at other times. I don't think we can check that box and say that we've demonstrated clearly that the experiences are happening during that time.
Hold on. Let me stop you right there. I hope I didn't cut you off too soon to make that point. But
go ahead.
I really want to get in there. That's the rub. I mean,
yes.
To use your term, but that's the rub the other way. You talked about triangulating data. The data is triangulating towards that point. So Penny Sartori's work is triangulating towards those experiences happening during a flat EEG. Dr. Jeff Long's research is triangulating towards those experiences, those memories being formed during a flat EEG. Steve, even the CO2 study that you mentioned is kind of offering support for your view. If you read in the conclusions, and I'm reading from it here, it says, our findings concerning the association between initial PET CO2 and the occurrence of NDEs therefore supports the hypothesis that NDEs occur during cardiac arrest. So really the data is triangulating towards that point. And
I disagree. I mean, I think that, first of all, there isn't consensus on that by any means, that there, you know, different people interpret that data differently, different researchers looking at NDEs and different scientists. I know, have you interviewed Susan Blackmore, by the way?
Yeah, I've read Susan Blackmore, 20 years ago, and I don't think she stands up very well. But what we're talking about is the CO2 study, because I have to get back to that, too. That was one.
All right, let's get back to the CO2. By the way, you got that wrong about the CO2 study last week when you criticized my interpretation of it.
I don't think I did. Let's go. You can tell me where I'm wrong. But right there, you know, it's interesting that you say there's not consensus and there's disagreement. Well, you're disagreeing then with the authors of the study who say that it supports. Okay, so.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, in fact, my criticism of them, was that I think they're leaping to that interpretation, but we can't really say that. And they, in fact, if you read their full conclusion, they say the other interpretation is that the high CO2 during the CPR could just be a marker of high CO2 at other times or other metabolic effects at other times. And that was my very point, which the authors of this paper agree with. But to get back to that, just from your discussion on the previous show, you said that I misinterpreted the timing of things in the study, but I think you misread the study about that, Alex, because what the study says, it was out of hospital cardiac arrest, right? But out of hospital CPR, resuscitation. But I think you interpreted that as the resuscitation happening in the field or something, like out of a medical setting. But actually, they're quite clear in their methods that the out of hospital CPR occurred in an emergency medical setting. It was just not one that was attached to the hospitals where they did the study. So the PCO2 was drawn during CPR. So I was absolutely right in my discussion of the study, misread that.
No, yeah. The PET CO2 was, but the blood was drawn after they were resuscitated.
Well, there was blood drawn during the resuscitation. There was blood drawn after the resuscitation, and the CO2 was elevated actually in both.
No, the CO2 was only elevated in after the first ones were normal.
I
go
disagree
check.
With that. Yeah.
Go check.
I got the study. So it says scores on NDE scale were positively correlated with the PET end tidal CO2. So, and that was the one that was drawn during the CPR. It was both. It says it was the PET CO2 and the partial pressure CO2. They both positively correlated with the end the risk of having an NDE.
They may have correlated, right? They may have correlated versus the other patients, but the PET CO2s were at normal levels relative to normal patients, normal walking people.
No, but the point is the higher CO2s. I'm not saying normal, abnormal, just the higher CO2s correlated with NDEs. That's the point of their paper.
Right. And we also should say that statistically, really, if they use, and Bruce Grayson pointed this out, the using the normal means that we do, the results aren't even statistically significant. So it's very, very weak in terms of the significance.
The correlation with CO2 was statistically significant. It was 0.01 p-value for the initial CO2 and 0.041 for the after CO2.
Right, but as Dr. Grayson points out, when you're doing multivariable analysis, and you would know this much better than I, so I don't want to get too far into that.
Yeah.
That the normal standards of significance that you would use are lower than 0.05.
I agree. I don't know if actually that's a good point. I don't know if they adjusted for multivariable analysis. And if not, then again, this is something else that I criticized the study about. It seems like they were anomaly hunting a little bit. So you could interpret the study in a few different ways. You could say, all right, so they were looking at a host of things. They found a few correlations. They might not really be meaningful. They could have just been anomaly hunting. My other criticism was that even though they were drawing the CO2 during the CPR, and that's the one that most highly correlated with NDE.
I think the other one.
You don't know when the experiences were happening. No, there's the higher statistical significance was with the initial CO2. I got it right in front of me.
The PET CO2?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It was 0.01 versus 0.041 for the one that was later. So the point is they don't know when the experiences of the NDE were happening because these people were interviewed several days later.
Right, but their conclusion is that it happened during the cardiac arrest. And there's one other thing,
Alex, we can't get away from this, Alex, because how do you make sense of that? Because why would CO2 have anything to do with an NDE if this is a mind separate from brain phenomenon?
I'm with you on that. One of my major, I did a whole show on why the scientific media covered this study with 11 patients that has all these inconclusive, correlation versus causation, why they covered it in the way that they did. But moreover, and I have to throw you in the lot here, that as they did cover it, that your conclusions directly contradict the study, the conclusions that they drew, the authors of the study. I mean,
I don't have to listen to the authors. I'm looking at their data and coming to my own conclusion.
But your conclusion is the same as mine, is that this study isn't important. It isn't significant. It isn't something we should look at. And particularly, it's small study size. It's not statistically that significant. There's the correlation and causation thing. And there's prior research, as again, Bruce Grayson, who is the guy whose survey they used and translated into Slovenian for their thing, as he said, there's plenty of better studies that contradict this idea that there's some connection between CO2 and NDEs. But I would have to add this one last thing, because I think it gets lost, and that's that the conclusion that they draw at the end, and this is another quote from the study, it's not thought possible to explain NDEs only in terms of physiological processes. So even these guys, when you talk about triangulating, they're adding, a brick to the other side of the wall, if you will, than the wall that you're building.
Well, I don't know how to make that sense of this study. I agree. This is a small study. You can't really make too much of any single study. know, this is only interesting in that it was prospective. There is some prior data to suggest that you can have, again, some of the NDE elements with hypercarbia, with hypercapnia, with increased CO2. So that's, you know, this isn't coming out of the blue. There is prior literature with CO2. Not saying necessarily correlating with NDEs, just people who have high CO2 can get some experiences that overlap with NDE. So that's why, you know, they would even look at that. But I didn't make too much out of this study. I also don't think that the author's conclusions are justified, and they even admit themselves that it could just be a marker for other things. That, you know, it could be that the people who had the higher CO2, you know, had, you know, the physiologically, yeah, whatever, better resuscitation, worse resuscitation, whatever. I mean, you could sort of make sense of it in any different way. It could be saying something that would affect the induction period where they when the experience could have been happening, or even the after effects. So you can't make that conclusion from this study, I don't think. And, you know, so I think we're actually on the same side here. Neither of us think this study is terribly important as far as NDE research, just one study. But also, I'm interested in just that notion. I mean, how could you use a physiological marker to argue that the experience is not physiological? I don't understand that. I think there's an inherent contradiction there. So I don't think this study can possibly lend support to the mind separate from brain hypothesis, because it's contradicting it by its very premise that CO2 would have an effect.
I'm not sure that I totally agree with you there, but the one point I would draw out, because it's going to be interesting when we follow up on the research that you provide, is these guys were looking at near-death experience, at least. Because mm-hmm. so much of the research that I see referenced, you know, when you're going to talk about out-of-body experience, and maybe you're going to send me Persinger and Blank and Olof and the rest of these guys. Hey, that's great. But if they weren't really looking at out-of-body experiences as they relate to near-death experiences, then we get into this other area that I guess I would accuse you of kind of stepping into in this conversation a lot, in terms of saying, hey, isn't there some overlap there? Doesn't that sound like some overlap euphoria? Couldn't we interpret that as overlap versus, you know, you got to go, if you think that overlaps with the near-death experience, then you need to drill down and use the same methodology that the folks who've studied the near-death experience do. And you need to really drill into these experiences. And I guess I'd come back to my question that I had for you. You know, how much, and I don't know the answer to this, Steve, but, you know, how much have you really looked into, analyzed?
I've read a lot of the, I mean, there's actually not that much, you know, in terms of medical research. You know, there's hundreds of relevant studies. That's the kind of thing you can kind of, you know, get a grasp on. And I've read a lot of the NDE research, not all in the last week. I've read it over years.
Okay, so what do you think of Bruce Grayson's research in general? What do you think of Jeff Long's research in general?
I think a lot of their research is descriptive. You know, a lot of it is just describing what has happened, and which is fine, and that's a good starting point. But, you know, I don't think that what we have is anything. Again, getting back to that the rub question about, is the experience happening during the flatline? There actually was one study that never got completed because it was set up and then nobody actually had an NDE, where they hid a hidden object or message or something out of view from anybody in the ER. The only possible way you could see this is if you were floating up near the ceiling, right? You had to be near the ceiling and have that kind of perspective. And the question was, if somebody were having a genuine out-of-body experience where their consciousness was out of their body and floating up near the ceiling, not just the subjective sense that was happening, then they would be able to see what was there and report on it. And that would be objective evidence of a true consciousness outside of body experience. Unfortunately, that they never pulled the trigger on that study, because while it was set up, nobody had a near-death experience, so they never actually carried it through. But I would like to see that kind of study.
That's Sam Parnia, yeah, and the whole AWARE group and Peter, yeah, Fennick, and they're doing that again.
I'd like to see those results.
Hey, we all would. But from what I hear is their preliminary results. You know, these things take years to publish, but Sam, yeah, Parnia has publicly said that the initial results are very positive in establishing, you know, their hypothesis, which they've been on for years. So I think that the direction line here is heading in that direction. And
well, we need to see published research. You know.
Well, we do, but we have published research in when we talk about Penny Sartori, and that's published research. We have published research with Dr. Jeff Long, and he looked at 23 patients who are under general anesthesia. Again, mm-hmm. there's no good conventional explanation why someone under general anesthesia would have these experiences. And in my report last week, I think I told you, you know, the account of when, now that's the account, but that's backed up by 150 question survey cross-correlated and done in a way to kind of prevent misreporting of information. But there's some good solid data to support this unexplainable case, this unexplainable situation of people having these memories, these experiences during general anesthesia.
I don't think that's unexplainable at all. Any anesthesiologist will tell you, Alex, let me explain it. You made a claim it was unexplainable, that patients can wake up during anesthesia. That happens. And they're paralyzed and they are on medications to block any pain. And during that, they imagine waking up but being completely numb to any sensations and being paralyzed. And that can absolutely produce an out-of-body experience. And yet there are other senses, you know, they could hear, for example, and they will visualize what the scene that they're imagining taking place in the operating room. That is a perfectly plausible explanation for those cases.
Not so, really. Now we had...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Really. We had GM Worley, Dr. GM Worley on, who I'm sure you know who he is, but
yeah.
He's a very highly well-credentialed, hardworking anesthesiologist in the Netherlands. We had him on twice, and we had Jeff Long on as well. It doesn't hold up. This idea of anesthesia awareness, first of all, that's rare. I mean, that's 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, if you look at the research. The other thing is it has all sorts of symptoms associated with it that don't show up in any of these cases. But just the pure odds that out of these, you know, 2,000 or so people in this sample, that 23 of them who were under general anesthesia, that they would all have anesthesia awareness, the odds are astronomically high.
Well, first of all, I'm not saying that they all had anesthesia awareness. Again, you're resorting to this fallacy that there's one explanation for everything. I don't think that's the case.
I was talking about
the unexplainable case that you present, that you specifically presented on the last episode. That one certainly sounds a lot like an anesthesia awareness case to me. There may be other things going on in some of those cases as well.
Let me just ask a question here. I'll make it really quick. What would it be if it's not anesthesia awareness? I mean, you're under anesthesia. If you have any awareness, it's anesthesia awareness.
Well, I haven't read every single one of those reports, so I don't know if they all fit narrowly into that description or not, or if it could be contaminated by memories that again occurred after the operation, et cetera. But if it is corroborated by them having to have awareness during the surgery, because they reported details that they could only know if they were aware of what was happening in the operating room.
Right.
Those cases can be explained by anesthesia awareness. Absolutely.
Which you'd acknowledge is extremely rare.
I don't know off the top of my head what the percentage is, but you know what? Even if it's 1 in 1,000, that's a lot of surgeries. That's a lot of cases that would be out there.
It's more like 1 in 10,000. And the population we're really talking about here in terms of cardiac arrest patients, at least in Jeff Long's study, you know, you're talking about a population of 2,000. So,
well, you know what? Maybe it's more common than we think. You know,
what the data says. The data does. I mean, a lot of people have been, there's a lot of anesthesiologists, researchers who've been looking at anesthesia awareness because it's a huge problem, right? You don't want to be becoming aware during anesthesia. So, we have a lot of good data on the fact that it is quite rare.
Well, but I think, you know, the point is, it depends on how you define what anesthesia awareness is. So in these quote unquote NDE studies, if you go back and you ask people what kind of experiences you had, right? It depends if they're defining the experience differently than how you're defining anesthesia awareness. You're going to come up using different criteria. You're going to come up with different statistics. But we don't know a priori that these are in fact different experiences. right? So in fact, I know this is circular, but if you count those as anesthesia awareness, then of course it's much more common. The point is we don't know. It's purely descriptive. That is, I think, an inherent weakness in a lot of this data. And this is why, again, I don't pretend that we know exactly what the NDE experience is, that, you know, what the near-death experience is. I think that the fact that all of the elements can be reproduced by brain phenomenon is strongly argues that in the final analysis it's going to be explained as a brain phenomenon. I think that there's no smoking gun evidence that it can't be a brain phenomenon. As much as you want there to be, it just is not out there, and there's no consensus on that there is, because there are viable explanations for everything that can explain it without rejecting the brain hypothesis. But the weakness of it, and the reason why I think that we're sort of making a lot of inferences and nibbling around the edges, is because most of the data is retrospective and observational descriptive data. You really can't do controlled experiments on this. You can't give people, you know, hypoxia or heart attacks to see what happens and control the variable. So this is going to take a long time to sort this out, because we're trying to use a lot of inference. And I think the state of the research at this point in time is such that, you know, we don't have a definitive answer as to what's causing near-death experiences. I think it's a very complex set of experiences, that it's probably going to have likewise a complex set of explanations. I think we're starting to get a handle on that, but we're not there yet. But I do think that, you know, the notion that it's caused by brain function is a completely viable explanation. Mm-hmm. We can't reject it with existing data, and I think there's a lot of reason to infer that it is. Let me give you one that I was trying to bring up before, and that is if patients who are getting a lot of drugs during the cardiac arrest, they tend to have fewer NDEs, and the NDEs are muted. The experiences have a lower chance of being vivid, and they have a lower chance of having a near-death experience. Now, if it weren't a brain experience, why would drugs have any effect on it whatsoever? That really only makes sense if the NDE is a brain experience.
Okay,
so you have
Steve. Okay, so let's look at that study. Send me that study. We'll pull it apart. We'll get the authors. We'll get the other folks who don't see it that same way. But I got to take that and turn it around, Steve. One, that's descriptive. You know, this whole thing of descriptive kind of sets me on tilt a little bit, because everything we're talking about here in terms of anesthesia awareness, all that,
I agree.
It's all descriptive. So
I agree. That's my point. I'm totally agreeing with you.
No, that isn't a good point, because we cannot, to suggest that we cannot probe these topics because the data that we're going to get back by doing so is going to be descriptive and not experimental, and therefore we can't go there.
I just said it's a lot harder.
We'll go back and play it, and everyone can interpret it the way that they want in terms of what you said and what I said. But what I'd say about your last point, Steve, is take that and take your argument now and allow me to use that argument as it applies to the anesthesia, the 23 anesthesia patients in Jeff Long's study that we just talked about, right? That mm-hmm. Why would they not have the normal symptoms that we associate with anesthesia, grogginess, amnesia, all these other things? So you just made a point of, hey, these people under these in this study that you're referring to, they were under certain drug that you would, why would that drug affect their experience? Well, why would the drugs from anesthesia not affect the experience of these folks?
Well, I'm not saying it didn't affect them, but, you know, drugs affect different people.
I'm saying it didn't affect them. I'm saying the data says that it didn't affect them.
No, but you're assuming that drugs affect people all in an identical way, and that's a naive assumption. That, you know, we know neurologists and physicians understand that there's a huge spectrum of how people respond to medications. People have different brains. Yes, they're remarkably similar, but there's also interesting difference.
But differences. See, if you
people
my
have
point,
different.
I'm saying that they weren't affected. So if
how could you say they're not affected? Maybe the effect was that it was impairing some parts of their brain significantly,
Why am I saying that? I'm saying that because that is exactly what was reported in Dr. Long's study. is that those patients who were under anesthesia were not different significantly in any respect from any of the other near-death experiencers he studied, with the exception of one, a slightly higher percentage of them had the tunnel experience. So that's what I'm saying, is that, to your point, is that you would expect the differences, and you don't see them.
But not necessarily. As I said, there could be multiple pathways that you can get to the same brain experience. If the NDE is largely due to some module in the brain being shut off, you know, while other modules are functioning, there could be 10 ways that you could make that happen. Anesthesia, hypoxia, hypercapnia, whatever. Just some kind of, maybe even just extreme emotional stress, seizures, other medications. But it would still produce the exact same experience, or at least a similar core experience, because it's the same net result on the brain, that this module shutting down. So it resulting in a different subset of different parts of the brain functioning, which therefore alters the way the brain constructs reality, and that produces an NDE. That's, it's an altered construction of how we construct reality, put ourselves into that reality, how we relate to that reality. You know, in fact, it may seem paradoxical, but if you impair reality testing, then that could give you a sense of hyper-reality, because now you're not filtering at all. It all seems hyper-real to you, and that can occur by impairing part of the brain. So I think that the similarities can make absolute sense, even under totally different situations, as long as it could plausibly result in altered brain function.
Well, I have to say that you've given us, in this hour talk we've had, kind of more grist for the mill than I could have possibly hoped for. So there's a lot of strings to pull, and I really do appreciate it. I think it's great, and you certainly haven't disappointed me or I'm sure any of the skeptical guests in terms of, one, your willingness to engage directly on these topics and just to provide a lot of insight and a very articulate way of expressing the other side, the materialistic explanation of what's going on. And for that, I have to really thank you.
That was a lot of fun, Alex. Anytime.
You know, it's amazing how much feedback I get from folks when I dare challenge any of these points, particularly with you, Steve. I mean, you're just so loved by your group out there. I think they always feel the need to kind of rally around and defend you. And what I found myself saying over and over in the forums was, I don't think you guys are giving Steve enough credit. And in the conversations I've had with you in the past, I got the sense that this kind of give and take is something that you're pretty familiar with and really not afraid of. So do you want to maybe give any kind of insight into the give and take that needs to go on to really get to the bottom of this and how we can really engage in this dialogue about these topics and about the research?
Yeah, well, this is how science functions, right? It's very confrontational in many ways. I mean, people take their positions and then they will defend them, you know, hopefully with logic and evidence, and then you sort it out. It's a meat grinder, and that's a good thing. You know, it doesn't have to be even polite, although it often is, but it often isn't. And if you've ever been at a scientific meeting, you hear respected, even elderly, very reserved scientists get very passionate and start beating each other up over some really minor technical point. But that's great. That's what science is all about. You know, I just think we need to keep it obviously intellectually honest. We want to keep focused on the science and the evidence and logic and honestly try to resolve these factual differences. You know, we're talking about this. It's good that you and I are talking about the research. We're talking about what's published, how to interpret it, what different people are saying. I know there's a range of opinion on this. I know that there are dedicated NDE researchers who think that it's a dualist explanation. I've read them. I know what they say. But there are also people on the other side who have, in my opinion, very cogent arguments against that. There isn't a consensus. I'm obviously on one side. I'm very compelled by the neuroscientific arguments because that's in my specialty, and I can very clearly relate to them. So I think this is all good. As long as we're not making it personal and we're focusing on logic and evidence, that it's very useful.
Couldn't agree more. Well, Steve, thanks again for joining me, and we'll be sure to follow up. If nothing else, by email, maybe we can steal a little bit of your time. I know you're a very busy guy, but maybe we can drop you an email here and there and get your ideas on some of the things we might find out.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, thanks again to Dr. Steve Novella for joining me today on Skeptico. Regarding the follow-up that I've done and some of these points raised, let me start by saying that the day after the interview with Steve, which was about a week ago, I started looking into some of the references that were made in the show, and I compiled a list. And I was still waiting for Steve to send me all those references, but I figured I'd send him first. And I said, hey, here are some things that I found. You know, is there anything that's missing? I didn't hear back from him. And then a few days later, I had done some more digging, and I actually sent him some quotes and said, hey, here's another reference, and here's what it says. And again, even to this day, I still haven't heard anything from him, which I understand he's busy and all that, but we're going to need some follow-up if we're going to get very far with this. But I did find, I think, the reference that is probably where Steve formulated a lot of these ideas that he has. And if you remember during the show, Steve actually asked me, he says, have you interviewed Susan Blackmore? And of course, we have, but that was a couple years ago, and back then we didn't talk too much about NDEs. But anyways, I was pretty quickly able to find the article that she published in 1996 titled Near-Death Experiences. And even though this isn't original research, it's just kind of a review of the current state of research. It's a pretty good article, and it really, I think, coincides point by point with a lot of the things that Steve is saying. So that's what leads me to believe that that's where he's formulating a lot of these ideas. Now, as an aside, since doing this research, I've invited Dr. Susan Blackmore to come back on Skeptico, but I haven't heard from her, so we'll have to see how that goes. Anyway, if you read this article, and I've provided a link in the show notes so you can do just that, the first thing that pops out at you is the date. I mean, this is 1996. This is 14 years ago. And really, all the best near-death experience research that you'd really want to look at has been published in this last 14 years. So if we look at one of Steve's main points, which is that NDEs are descriptively very broad, he says, and that there's most likely a bunch of different experiences that are being lumped together and called near-death experiences. Well, that's what people thought 14 years ago. But the best research that's been done since then, again, makes the situation look very different. One of the first pieces of research that really started to turn things in the other direction and is pretty famous in near-death experience circles is the study published by Pin Van Lommel. And what was unique about that study, it was the first time that someone had done a large-scale prospective study inside a hospital. And in this case, they only looked at cardiac arrest patients. So it really kind of eliminated a lot of this lumping different experiences together and all that. Now, a good summary, a more up-to-date review of the current near-death experience research, including a look at some of these more out-of-date skeptical positions, was published by Dr. Bruce Grayson in 2007. And I've provided a link for that paper as well in the show notes. For those of you who may not know, I mean, you should, Dr. Bruce Grayson is one of the world's leading authorities on near-death experiences, and he's the head of the division at the University of Virginia that looks into all this stuff, and he's just published scores of scholarly papers, so he's a real go-to guy on this. But his review addresses every point that both Steve's making and Susan Blackmore is making in their paper. So if you go read the two, I think you'll have a pretty good handle on this debate. Now, of course, I may be missing something. I may be framing this up incorrectly, and I'll just wait, and if Steve comes back to me and says, no, I wasn't really basing it off of Susan Blackmore's article, there's something else, then we'll look at that. But that seems to be where he's going on this. Now, let me hit on just a couple more points regarding Steve's interview, and then I'll leave the rest for a later follow-up. But these next two really kind of surprised me. The first has to do with the one actual reference to a paper that Steve did give during the interview. He said that Dr. John Bellani had looked at cross-cultural elements of near-death experience and concluded that as the cultural elements varied, so did the near-death experience. So this was pretty easy to find. You can Google it for yourself if you like. And I dug it up and I read it. And like before, the conclusions of the study seem to contradict what Steve is saying. Here is the conclusion. I'm reading it here from the abstract. This article concludes that though there are many common themes, there are also reported differences in near-death experience. Okay, good so far. Seems to support what Steve is saying. But listen to this. The variability across cultures is most likely due to our interpretation and verbalizing of such esoteric events through the filters of language, cultural experiences, religion, education, and their influences on our belief systems. So in the interview, Steve was saying that if you look at NDEs across cultures, you discover that they're different, and that that's a clue that these experiences are created in our brain because we know how these other cultural beliefs and attitudes develop. But what the research is actually saying, including the research that Steve cited in support of his argument, is that the differences we see across cultures in near-death experience are due to our interpretation, and that the experiences themselves are essentially the same. So this is another one that I'm happy to follow up on if there's a different opinion out there or if someone thinks I've misinterpreted that. I've also invited Dr. John Belante to come on Skeptico, but up to this point, I haven't heard from him either, so we'll just have to see how that shakes out. Now, the last point I wanted to touch on, and again, this is tough because we could do a whole show on anesthesia awareness, but I want to touch on it because I did dig up some interesting stuff here. Now, you'll recall that in my original critique, I read the account of Arnie, this guy who was under general anesthesia and then found himself looking down at his body from the ceiling. In fact, he recalled the specific view he had and exactly where things were. And he also recalled exactly what the doctor had said. He said that he couldn't believe this guy didn't have a fatty heart, something along those lines. So anyways, in our last interview, Steve was pretty emphatic in saying that there was a perfectly plausible explanation for this case. And his explanation was anesthesia awareness. And then we kicked around some facts about anesthesia awareness. But after the show, I did a little digging, and again, it wasn't all that hard because there's a ton of stuff out there on anesthesia awareness. It's a big problem. I mean, you don't want people waking up while they're under the knife. And here's what I found out. The first thing I found out is that anesthesia awareness is rare. Several studies have indicated that this happens 1 in 1,000 to as low as 1 in 50,000 times. The second thing I found is that the case like the one that I reported, and like the other 23 cases in Dr. Long's study, are off the charts rare. I mean, what the literature says is that if anesthesia awareness does occur, then about 94% of the time, there's panic and anxiety associated with it. So now remember, there's no panic and anxiety in this case, or in any of the other cases. They also found that about 70% of the time they have lasting psychological symptoms like post-traumatic stress disorder. Again, none of these patients experience that. 42% of the time they feel pain. Okay, again, none of Dr. Long's patients experience pain. It's also extremely rare for patients to remember whole sequences of events. Usually if they remember anything at all, it's just little snippets. And lastly, it's absolutely unheard of for them to have visual memories like this during anesthesia awareness. So again, you know, we come back to Dr. Novella's claim of a perfectly plausible explanation for Arnie's case. Well, that just isn't what the data says. So I've tried to contact a couple of folks who are experts in anesthesia. Again, my methodology, just so you don't think I'm stacking the deck, is really simple. I just go to Amazon and I search for anesthesia books and I just start emailing folks until one of them responds. In this case, I haven't had any bites, but I'm sure I will, and I'll pursue that if it seems like that's really fruitful and we need to go there. But I have a sense from looking at the literature that this is pretty well established, and this other position that Steve is taking, I just don't think he's going to pursue that very far because there really isn't any place to go with it. So in the end here, you know, I think it's great that Steve was willing to come on and engage with me about this research. He's certainly welcome to come back anytime or to email me on any points that I may have gotten wrong, and I'll share that with you and I'll share with you any response I might have. Because like I said during the interview, there's a lot of loose strings here to follow and no one can be sure how it's all going to shake out. But in the meantime, I think we have to just keep coming back to the data, the best research we can find, and try and make sense of it. And that's what I'm going to keep doing, and that's what Skeptico is really all about. By the way, I again want to thank a couple of Skeptico listeners. who helped me in the preparation for this show. Keith Wood, again, pitched in and had some great insights. And Isaac Miyakawa also had some great insights that he shared with me in a couple of emails. So thanks, guys, for all the help. We'll have a number of good shows coming up on Skeptico. I may be getting away from the near-death experience stuff for a little bit, but I'm sure I'll be coming back to it soon enough. It seems to be a really deep topic. In the meantime, if you'd like more information about the show and all our previous shows, be sure to check out the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find an email link, Facebook link to me, as well as a link to our forums where you can discuss the show with Skeptico listeners. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.